I am going to talk about teaching for Shalom. You know what Shalom is around here, so I won't harp on that. But I also want to contextualize it quite a bit. Here's the overview. You have it in the outline. I want to do a little bit of bio because that's part of the context as well, who I am, how I got into this, and so on. Then look at two current teaching contexts based on my travel. I'm going around to CCCU schools, and wow, am I learning a lot. And I'll share some of that with you, and then you can determine how fitting it is for this place as well. Thing is that I grew up in Chicago on the northwest side, a big fan of the Chicago Cubs. My friends say that turned me into a Calvinist because, you know, whenever the Cubs win, it's not because they played well. It's only because the other team played worse. And that's Calvinism in a nutshell right there. But seriously, my father was an alcoholic until it killed him. And my mother was a paranoid schizophrenic. And they fought and eventually got a divorce. And I ended up with my mother, who couldn't drive a car. She couldn't do anything. She was in communication with people that didn't exist. We had virtually no money, and we lived in a trailer. We were what used to be called white trailer trash. Remember that term? And I had to kind of raise myself. And one of the consequences of this was that I went inward to protect myself. I didn't have friends. I never went to a single social event in high school. And I have suffered from lifelong anxiety and depression. Bad. Been in medication for years and years, but I've had a lot of good help and a lot of good support. And as I'll talk about later, I think to some extent that has actually helped me in my teaching. I did well on the ACT exam, and I was able to go to university because of that, not because of my grades. My high school grades were very mediocre, and I wanted to study engineering. I went to the University of Illinois, started studying engineering. Then I met some people that were great people who were involved in InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. They shared the gospel with me, and before I knew it, I was becoming a follower of Jesus Christ. But I was so inept in terms of communication. And I started taking some communication courses, and I ended up a communication major, and then going on from there. I'm still interested in technology in terms of its application, its effects on people, and I'll talk about that with teaching here in a little bit as well. But I don't do so much of the design with it anymore. I eventually came to Calvin in 82 to start a communication program. I found out after I got here that they were going to eliminate the department and then hired me as a last attempt to save it, and nobody told me that. Until I was walking across campus and saw the provost, and he asked how it was going. Was I going to be able to save it? And I said, save what? He said, they never told you. I said, no. Started teaching at Calvin. I was fairly good as a teacher. Not excellent, but I made it. And then I had an experience where a student finished a final exam, blue book, and was leaving the classroom and took the notes for the course plus the textbook, which was written by me, and threw them all loudly in the trash and walked out. And the other students looked up and giggled. I was so angry. I was ready to get out of education. We could say it was one person or whatever, but sometimes these things get to you. And it really got to me. And over the next few days, I prayed about it, and I thought, what if I thought of my teaching in such a way that students would want to keep my notes forever? What if I just imagined teaching from that direction? That turned me around, and I made a lot of changes, and I became a pretty good teacher. Until the point where I was getting into my late 50s and early 60s, and here at Calvin, I was experiencing a kind of burnout. And also, the student culture was changing so much. And I felt disconnected from where the students were at and how to reach them. And it was really a difficult time, and then got a little bit older, and finally I think I couldn't do this emotionally anymore. Just couldn't do it. With advice from my psychiatrist, I'll say more about that in a little bit, I decided to take early retirement. In the back of my mind was, I'm going to come back to this whole thing of teaching, but I'm going to do it in a different way, where I'm not so rushed, I'm not so burned out. My study of communication led me to a kind of Calvinist view of communication, which is as follows in a nutshell. Communication is what we human beings do. It's a gift from God in order to create, to change, and to maintain culture or ways of life, including education and all the institutions, all of it. Communication is that process that God has given us. And if you want to look at what's going on in human endeavors, one way to view those endeavors is to look at the communication and say, what's going on? What's being created here, changed here, and so on? Because all of our relationships are mediated through communication. Our relationship with God, with other people, with ourselves, and to a certain extent, our relationship with the creation or environment as well. In this particular aspect of it, in my teaching, I've been very influenced by Jean Leclerc's book. I think it's kind of magisterial myself. The Love of Learning and the Desire for God. The Love of Learning and the Desire for God. Now, he explains the difference between monastic and scholastic education. I think he's in favor of the monastic vision, and that comes through. But what struck me about the book as I was learning how to be a teacher, and more recently after retirement, is that there's a lot in the monastic vision that we have lost that can be very, very helpful for Christian higher education today. My retirement activities, I'm mentoring faculty here and there. I'm mentoring ministers in their preaching. That's an interesting activity. I'm doing workshops and webinars on what I call servant teaching, teaching designed to serve students, to love our students as our neighbors, as we would want to be loved if we were our students. I'm doing webinars on faith integration and on leadership as well. I'm doing program reviews for schools, which gets me around to a lot of schools. And the neat thing there is that those schools become my labs along with the adjunct teaching that I'm doing. So that's kind of a little bit of a biographical context for what I'm doing with teaching now. I hope that helps. Two contexts to look at. This will be real fast. I don't know how much of this applies to Calvin because I'm just not plugged in here enough, but you can decide. But these are things with some examples I'll give you that I find all over the place. Declining student enrollments, not everywhere. There are some Christian schools that are really taken off with enrollment, and those are interesting places to talk with. Continuing faculty staff layoffs. I was speaking with a colleague recently, and he said to me over coffee, he said, well, 2 years ago when COVID was getting bad, they laid off 40 full-time faculty like that because they were scared that they wouldn't have revenue coming in with COVID. I said, wow, that's amazing. And these are people of all levels in their careers that were suddenly laid off. And they got so much pushback on that afterwards, and the decision seemed to be so capricious that the very high administration, the board and the president, ended up then letting go all of the academic deans and the provost and move one of the academic deans into the provost. A deepening curricular confusion, it's almost like we're moving from cosmos to chaos with curricula. And this is happening all over the place. Everybody's got ideas about what to do, including with core curricula. Reactive institutional organizations, reorganization. So there's a lot going on with what do you do with deans and provosts and who does what and what is an administrator and all this stuff. And amidst it all, the faculty seem to be asking themselves, where is the leadership? Or how is this being adjudicated, solved in some way? The rising administrative workloads for faculty in charge of new, marginally beneficial programs. And in my field of communication, this is amazing. Almost any school I go to do a program review, they say, oh, by the way, we're also going to start this and this master's program. And I know that those master programs are not going to make it there. Competition is brutal. You can't do it well. The only reason for the schools that are doing it successfully to do it is to have graduate students who then teach all of the courses that the faculty don't want to. And so they create graduate programs to have all these teaching assistants. It's quite a remarkable thing. At one place, by the way, public speaking courses that are being taught completely online by graduate students with almost no teaching experience and 90 students in the class. Now, you got to think about this. It produces revenue, but what's going on there? Escalating growing teaching load, 10 seems to be the standard now where I go around. 10 classes are not including the summer. the increasing faculty distrust of administrators and trustees and vice versa, you know about that, escalating fear of teaching amidst the wider culture wars. This is an amazing thing over the last few years. It's taken off. I got a call the other day from a colleague that I've been mentoring, and he said to me, I got a real problem. I'm scared. I said, well, wait. What are you scared about? He said, well, one of my colleagues just got a phone call from the provost, and he had to go to the provost. They wouldn't say what the meeting was about. And then he said that my colleague went in there, and the meeting was about the fact that a parent saw a textbook at home for one of the classes that the student was taking, and didn't like what was in that book, thought it was not adequately Christian, or it was too tied into the culture wars in one way or another, called up the university, got the provost and complained, and the provost was so worried about it, the provost immediately called up the faculty member and said, come in and bring a copy of that text. And my colleague said to me, well, you know, if this is going to happen to me, do I have to be careful about everything I have students read, it goes home and all of this? This is really an incredible world in which we live right now. Accumulating personal emotional hurt. It's all over. Almost everybody I talk with has hurts, who's a faculty member in Christian higher ed. And a lot of this hurt leads to resentment, by which I mean simply the feeling that the institution or the students or colleagues, the department or whatever, have let you down. They didn't live up to what they should do. So you get some anger from that. And mounting scholarly requirements without adequate faculty time and resources. I did a program review for a school recently. The chair of the communication department had not finished her PhD yet, had 6 months left, according to the university policy that she was getting the PhD from, to complete. And when I looked at what all she was doing and how much she was teaching and all, I thought, she's not going to get it. And of all of the faculty in that department, the students told me they liked her the most. When I talked to the dean said, yeah, if she can't finish it, she's out the door. So I waited until my review was complete. I sent it in, and then I called up the provost, and I said, you've got a problem here. You've got to provide some release time and some support, maybe even a faculty mentor who's been through this PhD stuff recently, or this is not going to happen. I just felt like I had to do that. And then waning collegiality, love, support, collaboration, encouragement. Faculty are not feeling like they have this. And when I was thinking about early retirement and went to see my psychiatrist, I mentioned this to him, and I said, I don't feel like I have the collegiality that I had when I started out in teaching. And he said, people like you are good business for me. He said, you would not believe the number of university faculty that have come in to see me over the last 2 years, and every one of them has cited a lack of collegiality. They don't feel supported encouragement. A student context, fear of the future, jobs, etc. You know what's out there. Escalating mental health issues. I was so glad in this recent book on the coddling of the American mind. If you haven't read this, you really need to. The coddling of the American mind, how good intentions and bad ideas are setting up a generation for failure. It's mostly about higher education. They have a section in there on mental health in students in universities today. And I've seen studies where up to 30% of students are suffering from depression and or anxiety. This is major, and it has to have an effect on how we teach and as well as how they learn. There's this spreading what I call cultural ADHD. I don't know what to call it, but students are, because of medications, of social media, of gaming and all, they're losing their ability to focus, to have attention, to stay with a project for a while. I've spoken in a few classes lately, not the adjunct thing over time, but just going into classes. One was at a big public university recently. Half the class was doing other things, usually on their phone, texting away while I was speaking. I thought, this is brutal. Declining sense of meaning, a purpose in life and schooling. We call them kids. They're acting like kids. Increasing religious doubt. They have private reservations. This, of course, is a big story in the church right now, isn't it? Young people leaving the churches. Not many new kinds of churches that are attracting them. This has an impact I'll talk about in our teaching. Growing fear of engaging others on social issues, except for those, a lot of their friends, who are in the same tribe, think the same way. a rising skepticism about the cost-benefit ratio of private versus public education, mounting irritation with academic busy work. This is one of the three things I'll mention in a few minutes. Students say to me off the record on campuses that they dislike about higher education now is the busy work. A snowballing dislike of textbooks, both the prose in them, poorly written, uninteresting, not engaging, nothing personal, and the prices of them. I think there's something to it. I remember looking at a number of editions of Samuelson's Introduction to Economics, and how back when I was a student, the book had something you could wrestle with and engage. It had a perspective and all. And how increasingly it became, like most textbooks, a book that's written by nobody in particular for everybody in general. Pretty bad reading, even if there is some good information in it. Increasing sense that faculty do not like or appreciate the students or like teaching them. You can imagine them picking up on this because sometimes we feel like this, right? Growing importance of non-faculty staff in student mentoring and relationships. I've been talking with some people who do consulting to schools about enrollment, and this is one of the things that they mentioned to me as well. Often what keeps students, retains them at schools, is relationships they have with non-faculty staff. Some of it's sports people or advisors or whatever it is. Now, for the next 20 minutes, what I'm going to do is to go through 15 practices. These, unfortunately, the way I'm presenting these are somewhat decontextualized. So in the book I'm writing, they're contextualized. I pulled them out in order to present them to you, hoping that you would find some traction with them. Even if two or three of these are something that would really help you, and you can run with it. But unfortunately, the way I'm doing this with the limited time we have is not what I like to do when I go out and do a day-long or a half-day workshop. But so be it. Let's see how it goes. The number one thing that I say to faculty when I go around now, they ask me, what's the best thing I can do to improve my teaching? Increase your gratitude. Increase your gratitude. We all live along a continuum. On one side is gratitude, on the other side is ingratitude. And then our communication takes place, including our teaching, takes place along that continuum. On the ingratitude side, you get things like cynicism and criticism and resentment expressed. The culture in which we live, at least in North America right now, there's a lot of ingratitude related to these issues that I mentioned. And it affects our teaching. It affects all of our communication because, as Jesus says, our words flow from our hearts. So the orientation of our hearts, you know what I'm talking about here. I'm offering a kind of Augustinian turn on this. The orientation of our hearts, what we really love and desire, in some cases what we love and desire is very different from what we need to in order to be great teachers. It leads us astray. Students tend to be attracted to people who are grateful, for them as students, who are grateful for the opportunities to teach, who are grateful for life, grateful for their families, grateful for the subject they teach from, grateful for the information that they're teaching, and they tend to be unattracted. They don't want to identify with faculty who are not in that kind of category. I have a kudos folder to help me stay grateful. When I get nice notes from people, I stick them in there, and then when I start to get down, I pull that out and I read through those and I say, that's a good one, that's a good one. Well, the other day I got an email from a teacher I've been mentoring at a southern school. Now, I was there 3 years ago before COVID and I did a workshop on teaching. And then she asked me to come to one of her classes and to demonstrate what I had talked about in the workshop, which I did. 3 years later, 1 or 2 weeks ago, I get an email from her. She says, your visit here was so great, and I learned so much from your appearance in my class. She said, I used to have middling, not very good student evaluation. She said, the most amazing thing happened this semester. She said, I got perfect student evaluations. I never got perfect student evaluations. What the heck is this about? She figured out what I did there would work for her and her style and her institution and her students. She recontextualized it. It was an amazing email. that goes right in my kudos folder. I know that I need worship. I need good worship, vibrant worship. And I don't want to go to a church that's in conflicts and fighting over who the president should be or anything else. I have a gratitude board at home. And I put this in my office right where every time I leave the door to my office, I see what's on the gratitude board. So when I go out in the, you know, it's like the end of worship. Go into the world to serve, you know, gratefully, you bunch of bums. And so I try to do that myself. First thing in the morning when I'm still in bed, soon as I awaken, before I get out, I thank God for another day of life. Because I know if I don't do that, I'm going to start thinking about the things I have to do that day and the things I'm worrying about. And that's not where I want to start. I started a practice when I was still here at Calvin, where when I would come down Burton and I would turn in where the Calvin sign was and I would see that sign, I would thank God for Calvin College. I would thank God for all the people that over all the years that have contributed to this place and that I could be part of it now. And then periodically I would thank God out in front of the sign that's right out here about the history of this place. And the other thing is I try to remember, well, I do it, it's only a matter of how many, to thank other people every day, to thank other people, to cultivate a lens of gratitude. I find that that makes a huge difference. Number two, address students' major first day concerns. This is what I came up with from my own laboratory teaching and running around talking to faculty and all, but then I looked at the research and I thought, wow, the research supports this too. Students want to know, will a teacher like me and can I do well in this class? They're thinking about these two things on day one. So will the teacher like me? We have to be genuinely likable. Genuinely likable. This is a kind of a place to start. We have enough gratitude to be likable, and students get a sense, hey, I like this person. And they get a sense from that, too, that the teacher likes them. Gratitude is infectious. It's the real booster shot in life, which reminds me of a funny story about when I was still at Calvin, and they went through all this core stuff about virtues in the core. And then I think it was the philosophy department, Lee Hardy posted a note, and he said, hey, by the way, it's very interesting. The Heidelberg Catechism is one-third, approximately, about gratitude, and we didn't put gratitude in a list of virtues. And I thought, how in the world can we do that? Have a smile. Express honor and thanks. First day of class, I say to the students, thanks for coming. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're in this class. In fact, I'm honored that you're here. And it's going to be a good class. I begin and end every class with thanks. Thank you for coming. At the end of class, thanks again for coming. Then I tell them the first day of class, I will never evaluate you as a person based on your academic performance. Because I've been there. I've struggled. And I'll tell them usually one story from my own life where I was going through hell at home and could barely get to school. And I say to the students, you know, you may have more important things going on in your life than my class. And that's okay. You deal with those things. It doesn't mean I'm going to give you a better grade for it. But I want you to know that I love you through it, even if you don't tell me about it. And this is an important one related to the context I gave you earlier about students bailing out of the faith. I've discovered that that first day of class, I have to address faith without giving them theology, without giving them doctrine. And this is generally how I do it. Now, this is a Christian institution. You know, I'm a Christian, by the way. By that, I mean to all of you that I am a follower of Jesus Christ. But I want you to know, if you're in here and you're doubting in your faith, I'm glad you're here. Because I have doubts too. There are times in my life when things have gone certain ways or the church has been hypocritical or I've read about the history of the church and I say, well, what am I doing here? And then I come around. So I'm glad you're here. And I say, oh, and one other thing. Whatever rascal wrote that book of Hebrews has a great thing in there. He's talking about all the great people of faith, and he goes, he gets to Abraham. Oh, man, this great father of so many people, Abraham. And what does he say about him? He said he went forward in faith even though he didn't know where he was going. And I say to the students, that's how I feel much of the time too. So if you feel that way, it's okay. I'm glad you're here. Now, I will get email from students after class just based on saying that, because of the situation we're in where there are so many students doubting and they don't want to raise it, and they're kind of put off by being locked into a Christian institution that they think may be too oppressive to them. Can I do well in the class? Yes. It's a kind of covenantal thing. I'm going to do my part, you do your part. We're going to map that out in the syllabus. I'll say more about that in a minute. You can do well. I'm going to make it very clear. I'm going to give you excellent feedback, and you can make it in this class. Whether you're going to get a high grade or medium grade or whatever depends a lot on how much work you do, and if you need help, whether you seek me out, but you can do it. You can do it. I want them to be as encouraged as possible. It's together. We're going to work on this. I tell them I'm going to have some regular times for student feedback. I'll tell you what that is in a minute. And I also admit to them that not only was I not always a good student, but that I'm not always a good teacher. I have up days and down days. And you're going to have up days and down days as a student, but this is what we're in, living under the shadow of the fall, including our own laziness or conflicting duties in life, and who knows what, but this is the way it is, but we go on together. And I say to them, we will both fail at some things. That's just the way it is. Now, number three is really important. This revolutionized my teaching, by the way, just this one practice, ongoing course evaluations. More and more, I thought to myself, you know, these end-of-semester evaluations are of limited value. You can go through them. They ask standard questions, helps the institution look across faculty and all. But I thought, what if I did it differently? So three or four times in the semester, the first time, usually at the towards the end of the second week, I hand every student an index card. And I said, don't put your name on it. I'm going to collect these and read them. Don't put your name on it. Unless you want to, I'd like to answer three questions real quickly. What's going well? What's not going well? And what can I do better? And I take those, I read them, I make adjustments. Next time I do it, let's say 6 weeks later, I make more adjustments. Each time after I do it, the next class, at the beginning of class, I give a report as to what they said and what I'm doing differently. It allows us to get a better sense of where students are at. We become listeners to the students, to the learners, to the colleagues, whatever you want to call them. I encourage you to do that. By the way, if I get about half the students say one thing and another half says something different, I've got a very interesting educational practice for this. I then pick two or three students from the class and I say, okay, here are the cards. This is at the next class now. There's disagreement among the students among these two. I'd like you to take these and decide what we ought to do and report at the next class. Number four, create hospitable, covenantal syllabi for community, for mutual responsibilities. Did you see that report recently about the music teacher that put $50 somewhere on campus and put it down in the syllabus? And no student during the whole semester saw that on the syllabus because students generally don't read them or they don't read them well or whatever. that's funny. But I think of a syllabus as kind of like the rules of St. Benedict, you know, or Bonhoeffer's Life Together. It's kind of a covenantal document, mutual responsibilities and opportunities, including my responsibilities. Am I going to return graded things in a timely fashion, for example? Am I going to provide feedback for the students, as I do with the cards? Am I going to provide a way for students to challenge grading? And I do, and I'll tell you what I do with that in a minute. I tell them also, hey, I'm going to throw out any questions in any exam that more than 50% of you miss, because I figure it's probably my problem. And I'll give extra credit to those who got it right. I talk about places for latecomers. So what I do first day of class is say, okay, the chair's near the door. I need one or two people that are going to protect those every class so that nobody sits there, only latecomers when they come in, because I want every latecomer, even if they come in 5 minutes before the end of class, and I tell them this the first day, to come and sit there and not to feel embarrassed or have to walk in front of other people. I tell them, always come if you're late, always come. If you can't, it's okay. I ask them to help each other with note taking. It's a covenantal thing. Share your notes. Share them widely. Share them with two or three different people. Your exam prep, share them. If we do a session on how to study for a particular exam and you can't be there, share it. If you need something recorded because you can't be in class, ask me about it. I'll normally record it for you. Although now I'm inclined to record all of my classes for reasons I'll get to in a few minutes. And then this is the thing that the students most respond to in my syllabus on the rules of St. Quentin here is I say to them, what to do if I'm not there? Call my cell. Here it is. Find out what's wrong. Say, well, why do that? I say, there's no 10-minute rule. You call. I said, if something happened to you, I would want to know about it. What if I was in a car accident? Or what if I just had a flat tire two blocks away and I was fixing it and I was going to be a little late? Call. We're in a community here. Number five, develop a semester-long personal professional schedule. What I discovered early on in my teaching was I would get in these situations where I suddenly had a bunch of grading or a bunch of kinds of prep that was beyond what I was expecting. And then I had personal things going on in life, and it was a disaster. It was so stressful. And I wasn't providing the kind of turnaround on things for students that I wanted. And so I said, how do I get around that? And I said, well, the way I get around that is to schedule my education-related time and my personal time a semester in advance. So that when I have, let's say, a bunch of papers to grade, say they're due on a Thursday, Friday and Saturday, I'm going to be grading papers, or at least parts of those days, because my goal is going to be able to have the paper back the next week. I often tell students, I will have anything you turn in back within two class sessions, and I put that in the syllabus. But I can only do that by protecting the schedule. Six, teach to your strengths and your joys. I've given up, both with preachers and with faculty, thinking that every teacher, every preacher can do everything well. It's just not going to happen. It amazes me that where I go, the Christian schools I go to, there's almost no recognition or talk about this. And not all faculty are going to lecture well. It's not going to happen. We can improve them somewhat, but there's a gift involved there, particularly for really good lecturing that's extemporaneous and very engaging and interesting and starts with a story or a hook of some kind that makes the students want to wonder what's going to happen. I can do that well. You ask me to do a student group that meets outside a class and we're headed to disaster. I have never learned how to manage out-of-class groups. I'll either be too involved in controlling or not enough, and the students will complain to me. In the book I'm working on, I got a story where I had whole groups coming to me to complain about one other person. And where it seemed like in a given semester, most of the email I received from that whole class was about dysfunctional groups. That's not my thing. There are faculty who can do that well, but I can't. So I think we teach around our strengths. By the way, another thing I do really poorly is multiple choice exams. Writing those suckers so that they are fair and there's a sort of the equal plausibility of any of the answers, I can't do it. And so I go and I grade them and I return them, and then the student in class says, well, this is how I took what you were saying. Saying, oh, crap, I'm a communication guy. And he says that, and that's right. And so I say, you're right. In fact, 50% of you missed that puppy, it's out. But then there's another way out I'll talk about in a minute. A reduced student in your own busy work. If I had to say there's one thing that's going to reduce stress, this is it. How much of what we do and what we require students to do is busy work? Now, that's their term. Students love that term to describe us. We are purveyors of busy work. How much? It seems to me that what really works in education is a kind of repetition and application of the essentials. A repetition and application of the essentials. What are the essentials in a course? And how do we get those across in a way? It's repetitive. If you do less, you have more time for repetition and also to apply them in whatever way is appropriate. And then a reduction in the non-essentials. hard decisions have to be made here, right? What's essential and what's not? The big problem is with the information-rich courses, courses that have to have a lot of information. So what I started doing with those, and it's worked marvelously, is along with the syllabus, I give the students a 7 to 10 page outline, single-spaced, for the whole course. See, this is all the information. You know, and they, oh man, can't handle it. What are you doing here with all this information? I'm telling you up front what it's going to be. Some faculty don't. And then we're going to go through it in that order. And you can check off. And you can ask questions. And when it comes to exam prep time and we get together, you can say, hey, what about this or that? It's going to be there. And I include the page numbers on the different readings related to the different topics. That's how I do an information-rich course in the context of where students are at with the cultural ADHD. Assign shorter, engaging texts. The writing in them is just getting worse and worse. And I can understand students don't like them. What's interesting to me is that we all are in disciplines, and disciplines have some standard textbooks. And we rarely ask students to evaluate those. Why would we do that? We know what the best is for the students. So I was at a school 2 years ago doing a program review, and I went into the cafeteria and started talking. And it turns out all the students had taken public speaking at this Christian university. And I said, what was the textbook? And they told me one of the mainstream textbooks. In fact, the most popular one. It has about 70% of the market. And I said, what do you think of it? You really want to know? Yeah. I won't tell you all the words they used. But it was bad. In fact, then one of them said, we don't read it. And only if there are required quizzes on the readings, and then we buy just a few copies and we pass them around to look at it just before the quiz. And I thought to myself, why would the faculty not be asking the students about what they thought about these supposedly helpful materials? I wrote a little supplemental book on public speaking from an Augustinian perspective. Thin little thing to use with the big standard textbooks, which are vastly overwritten and overpriced, and students hate them. But at least I wrote that to add to it, and then a lot of faculty said to me, we still can't stand it with the big text anymore. We want to get rid of that too. Can we work on that? And so then I wrote a second edition that's bigger to try to provide a way to do that. About a week before class, I send out a survey to all the students in the class. I want to get a little bit of information. I want to get some dialogue going. I want to know my audience better. So in the biblical sense, I'm not a fool. A fool is someone who speaks first and listens later. And we all have that tendency. I ask them for their preferred name. So on the first day of class, we go through the roster. I use their preferred name, their majors, their minors. And I ask them about regrets. What regrets do you have about the major? Would you wish you had majored in something else? Your main hobbies and interests. And I swing back to that later in the semester if they're having problems coming up with what would be a good topic for a course. Any learning issues or opportunities that I should be aware of. Your contact information, and how do you prefer that I contact you? I ask them what their favorite teacher was and why, and then I learn from those things. And by the way, the favorite teacher stuff mostly has to do with virtuous qualities in teachers. It doesn't have much to do with a teacher being easier or difficult. What would you like to learn in the class? And then the first day of class, I bring along paper copies for those that haven't responded yet or are new to the class. 10, send the syllabus a week in advance for feedback. And then the first day of class, talk about it. What do you think about this? What might need to be changed or whatever? Again, it's dialogue and it does get them to read. 11, plan extra time for each class session. I normally figure on a 50-minute class, I'm going to aim for 10 minutes left. Then it'll maybe be 5 minutes less. But at least I won't get into that thing where they're all packing up and everybody's ready to go. And we'll be able to relax for a minute, pray if it seems relevant to do at that time. And also I'll be able to summarize what's going on. I use index cards or text messaging to start conversations on sensitive topics. I wouldn't have done this 5 years ago, but in the last couple of years with everything going on, it works really well. So I'll hand out cards and say, what do you think about this issue or problem? And it's related to social concerns and the like. And then they don't put their name on it, and then I get the discussion going that way. I started when I was at Cal in cafe hours. I would simply take time in different cafes on campus and then text the students early in the morning and say, I'll be there, come by. Some students would come by, others would accidentally see me coming by. Oh, that's right, I wanted to talk to you. That practice saved me so much time because students were more willing to take problems to me that way. It was less intimidating. And the big difference was with Asian students, by the way. Asian students, for me, would rarely come to office hours. Hispanic students would come to office hours and talk for 2 hours. Big, big difference. And this brought in the Asian students quite well. Recording, I mentioned, I think recording is really important. We're moving in a different kind of educational world here, where we need to have quote-unquote material. That's what we like to say, right? Material. What if you're going to miss a class and you have something recorded? What if there's one lecture you're doing particularly well and you record that one and you have the students view that outside of class and then you flip it and you have some discussion of it in class? What if you're suddenly having to teach online and you have things recorded? I think this is something we're all going to be looking at. And 15, provide a friendly way for students to challenge grades. Wow, can students get upset? They're increasingly easy for students to be upset about a grade, in my experience. So I explain to them how it works. When I hand out graded material and I say, now this is not necessarily the final grade, that eases a little bit. And then I say, here's how it's going to work. We're going to run through it in class, and then the next class you can give me in written form why you think I should give you more credit. And you can refer to the text, you can refer to my lectures, whatever you want to do, but it has to be written. And I'm not going to talk with you right after class, because that doesn't work. Often they're too emotional at that point. And appeals must be in writing so they cool off. And I admit that I might be wrong. And so if you think so, let me know. And I recall the first day commitment I have to not evaluating students as persons based on their academic performance. Let's put those cards around, okay? Otto, meanwhile, I'll answer any questions you have that you're willing to go for.
You talked about doubting students early on.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 10 years into my time here, Dale Cooper, wonderful guy, decided to do Bible studies or a book study or something and gather students. And I wrote to Dale and said, I'll take the doubters, the deadbeats, and the burnouts. You find me a group of those people, not the God lovers right now.
Yeah.
Okay, those folks. So he did, and about a dozen gathered in the fish house for our first meeting. And the second meeting, I gathered a couple of colleagues because they were better at burnout talk than I was, and 40 people came. And the third meeting, 80. So if you offer an opportunity, I think that population,
yeah,
at least it did.
Yeah, and the students will come to my office.
Yeah.
You know, I had one that came to my office here, Calvin, one time that asked me, said, you know, based on what you said, I'm not sure I'm a Christian. I said, oh, that's interesting. What do you think a Christian is? And then there was all this stuff about ephemeral, cultural, political stuff. I said, hey, that's not what it's all about. Following Jesus is the name of the game here, I said to him. That's what we're doing. Now, that's a simple way to put it. I stopped years ago ever using the word Christianity in class. I mean, it has almost no meaning to students except the Crusades. That's about all. And why should they want to have anything to do with that? Or rules and regulations. What students define as busy work, we often consider to be important learning tools. Yeah, that's absolutely right. What can you say to help us figure out the difference? If I can explain to a student why something is important, why they should do it, why it's relevant for their learning and for their life, then I don't consider it busy work. If I can't make that connection for them myself, then I consider it busy work. So that's a kind of a relevance test, but there needs to be more meat on that. We'll stop here after this one. How do you know when you've got too many commitments, too much going on? Peace. When I took early retirement, I did not have peace. I was living in a constant state of agitation and worry and fear. And I thought to myself, how could this be at a Christian institution? And this is before all the more recent layoffs and all. You know, what kind of community do we have or should we have that we can live in where we see that sign when we drive up for Calvin and we say, I'm glad I'm here. I want to be part of this. I love the place, I love the people, and I feel beloved. And when that stuff starts evaporating, then we have to, well, we do have to say no to a lot of things. There's much we're doing in our lives that's busy work. I'm going to finish with one negative thing and then the doxology. So the negative thing is this. I think we have, if you look at that list of the faculty-student context that I'm talking about, we have brought a lot of that upon ourselves, and we've not so much individually, but through the momentum of practices and institutions that hangs over all of us and creates implicit expectations. And it's not healthy and it's not creative. When I go out speaking at churches, one of the top questions I get is, oh, you're at Calvin College. That's where the faculty are liberal. And I say, oh, that's interesting. And in fact, then now in the last 2 years, but I think they, because they heard it on TV or whatever, they'll say, you know, higher education, that's liberal. All you professors are liberal. That's a tough one to give an easy answer on. But it's got me thinking lately that when it comes to politics, faculty probably are more liberal than the population overall. But when it comes to pedagogy, creative pedagogy, developing new practices, I think faculty are extremely illiberal and much willing to go along with the way things are and not consider something else, even if it's pitched to them in a way that seems consonant with the gospel, with scripture, with catechism, with living in shalom. So here's my final note on this. This is not the end of the story. I'm not the end of the story. Sometimes things have to get worse before they get better. And more as I travel around doing my laboratory work in different schools, I find people willing to talk about these things and say, where do we go from here? 10 years ago, never heard that. And David Smith here is one of the people who's generating that. And so I'll just tell you publicly, David, I wouldn't be doing this kind of thing if it weren't for you ahead of me charting a course that's really fine. Thanks, everybody.